Saunders reel number 5.
Yes. During my time with the number 1 squadron, we had a chap called Lustig, who was one of these fellows who went around with another pilot giving exhibitions and flights to people at the seaside. And Lustig was second pilot to Pigou. Well, he joined the Flying Corps, and he was with number 1, and after application, he was given a chance to show his paces at with number 1 squadron, Seafly. Well, Major Longcroft told him to go up and was watching him. He sent him up in a Blériot, and we thought he gave a wonderful exhibition. But Major Longcroft turned him down on the assumption, or on the statement, that he didn't want foolish pilots who would kill themselves. He wanted people who would do straightforward flying.
What exactly did he do when he was giving his...
Well, there was a shed at one corner of the aerodrome, and he dived at this, got very close, and then zoomed away from it, you know, climbing turn and all that sort of business. Well, Longcroft didn't like this, so he was turned down. But I heard afterwards that he eventually got his wings and gave quite a good account of himself.
That incident makes Longcroft sound a rather sort of conservative, stick-in-the-mud kind of person. Was that your impression?
No, he wasn't. But in those days, Lustig was in the ranks. And unless you were an officer, you weren't supposed to have sufficient brains to be capable of flying. It was sort of a closed shop, because it was only the officer class who could pay for his private tuition and civil life. And that's really how they came, because previous to 1913, the Flying Corps didn't encourage or teach many people to fly at all. They got them all in. The officers had to learn at their own expense.
Could you develop for me this question of the relationship between the flyers, who were exclusively officers, and the NCOs and other ranks, who were always on the ground?
Well, it was simply a question of class. But if an NCO was lucky enough to get his wings, and he was the pilot, and he had any officer of any rank up, staff officer or anything else, the pilot was absolutely in charge and would not take any instructions from the officer, however senior he was. And he wasn't considered in the wrong. If the officer wanted to see a certain thing, he requested the pilot to let him see it. He didn't order him to. But of course, it didn't always do to assert yourself too much, because as soon as that aircraft landed and you stepped on the ground, you were very much putting your back in your proper position.
Were there any circumstances, or can you remember any particular incidents, where you wouldn't and didn't do what a pilot passenger wanted you to do, to illustrate this point?
Well, for instance, if you were up with a senior officer, and he told you to land in a certain field, and you didn't think that was safe, you just told him out straight, "No, I'm not landing there. I land you in that field over there." And if he wasn't satisfied with that, well, then you just carried on.
And this was this was accepted, the officer was captain, the pilot was captain.
The pilot was captain under all circumstances, irrespective of the rank of the passenger. But the passenger got his own back, if he liked, when you landed.
So in practice, you wouldn't push this too hard?
No, you wouldn't push it too hard. Major Salmon took us over at Netheravon, and we went overseas with him eventually. But about a week before we went overseas, we were all called on parade and told we had to be inoculated, but that it was entirely voluntary, and under no circumstance could any man be compelled to be inoculated. But if any man refused to be inoculated, he wouldn't be allowed under any circumstances to go overseas. So, of course, everybody was inoculated. And eventually, we got packed up and ready and started off from Netheravon.
Was there no chance that some people might refuse the inoculation simply to avoid going to war at all?
Well, in those days, we'd had the South African War some years previously, but there were very few people left who had served in that, and war to us youngsters was simply an event, and we were all very keen to go, and we joined up to go. We were all volunteers, of course, joined up to go, and if anyone had thought that they weren't going to go overseas, going to France, well, they would have deserted.
Seriously would have deserted?
Seriously would have deserted, because they joined up. Peculiar way, a thing to say is, but sort of looked at it as a sport, as if we were going out big game hunting. And that atmosphere still lasted in the Flying Corps up to about coming towards the end of 16, even when you met aircraft in combat.
Can I put this to you? Obviously, it was impossible to send everyone overseas. There had to be a home establishment. Yes. Therefore, it was inevitable that some of these volunteers would be disappointed. Now, taking up your earlier point that they would desert, from your own experience or from information you had from any other source, did in fact such desertions take place when people didn't get overseas postings?
Well, a lot of them deserted. I met two or three of them later on, who had deserted and then rejoined again, or rejoined some other regiment, simply to get overseas.
And at this stage, because there was a war on, presumably the penalty for desertion would be death.
Yes, it was in those days, but they joined up in some other name and some other regiment which they thought was going overseas.
Would you describe for me the journey from Netheravon to France with No. 1 Squadron in February 1915?
Well, what we consider the great day arrived, and we started off from Netheravon. I was driving a Crossley tender at the time, and we were going to Avonmouth. And after a very torturous journey there, because nobody had any experience of convoy driving, and if the fellow, and the roads were very, very dusty in those days, and if the fellow in front was going too slowly, you either dodged round him and got in front of him so as to give him your dust, or you dropped back. And the motorcyclists, their job was to keep going up and down the column all the time, passing one another to one way or the other. And their duty was to report anybody to the officer who was leading the convoy that somebody had broken down. That was their main object. But as far as taking a position and keeping that position, there was no rules or regulations laid down, and we just got there. And we got to Avonmouth, and when we got there on the quay, there was this big boat, and we were told then that we weren't going on that boat because there was a rumour that there was a submarine waiting for us. So we packed all the vehicles on that boat, and then we went down to a shed, and we had a mug of tea given to us and a couple of hard biscuits, and told them, make yourself all here for the night. So we put down in this shed, we put down our ground sheet and blanket, got our blanket out and went to sleep. Next morning we were called at Ravalli, and the cook then had really got another more tea ready and got another couple of biscuits. And we had them, and we hung about the docks not knowing what we were doing. But, of course, in ranks, we weren't allowed to wander about. And lunchtime came, we had some more tea and some more biscuits. And then we were told that later on that we weren't going that day. So we went back to our sheds, and all, of course, under the discipline of the NCOs. We were marched back. We didn't just wander back anyhow. We packed up there that night, and next morning, same thing happened. And about 12 o'clock, we were bundled into a train. And this train took us to Southampton. Well, when we got to Southampton, we went down on the docks.
Had all your equipment been put on the train as well?
No, no, we had our...
We
had our equipment with us. We were carrying it. We were wearing it.
I was thinking of the lorry and the tender.
Oh, no, they'd been put on this big ship down. You see, they'd been loaded on that. And they went over independently of us. Well, the day before we went to... We started from Netherhaven. All the air crew were sent to Farnborough. And there they picked up some Avros and Morans, new ones to us, and flew them over to St. Omer, so they were waiting when we got over there. But we stayed at Southampton that day and the next day, and then we were staying at a school, some day school that had been cleared out for the occasion. And the following night at 6 o'clock, we were marched down to the docks, and we were put on board a little paddle steamer called the Balmoral, which used to ply between the Isle of Wight and the mainland for pleasure trips. We found we had about 3,000 infantry on there before we got on. And there wasn't room, really, for about more than about 2,000, but we were all there with our packs and everything, and everybody happy and going to France, and infantry just as bad, all smoking. Well, just as we got halfway down Southampton Water, they battened down the hatches so that we were all down below and covered in. And the Southampton Water was a bit choppy. She started to jump about a bit. Well, everybody, with the exception of three or four of us, were sick. So, of course, I was lucky, in as much as I'd had a lot of... done a lot of work on the sea, sailing and one thing and another, so it didn't affect me too much. And then next morning we left just after between 6 and 7 at night, and we didn't get off Le Havre until 6 o'clock the next morning. Of course, halfway across they had to open the hatches because everybody was sick down below. And it appears, now that was 12 hours nearly, we were just getting from Southampton to Le Havre, it should take about 3 hours. But we found out afterwards that owing to this rumour of the submarine, we were zigzagging all over the channel all night. Well, of course, when we got into Le Havre, it was nice, and we got into the river, everything was nice and calm, and sailed up the Seine and got up there to Rouen about 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was a beautiful run up there, and everybody got more or less fit again. When we got up there then, we were marched off, and as we were going off, there was one sergeant major at one side of the gangway and the other at the other, and one hand was a tin of bully beef, and the other hand is just two of these big hard biscuits, like dog biscuits. And they said, "That's your rations for the next 12 hours. You can eat it when you like. That's all you're getting." Well, we sort of come to accept this because as part of the military, we expected rough times, and we sort of took it as sort of a joke. And we couldn't get our stuff off that day, but the following day all the lorries were unloaded and we were just marched up out of our shed, and we got into our lorries and we started off for Saint-Omer. Well, it was too long a journey for the time we had. We had to stop the night. We stopped at a farmhouse. There was some more tea brewed up and some more biscuits. We were told not to touch our emergency rations, keep them for later on. That was the tin of bully beef and the biscuits. So we had some tea there, and then we were told we were dossing down there for the night.
This was just your squadron now, was it?
No, just this squad, just yeah. number one squadron, you see, because we left the infantry at Rouen. And then we stopped there the night. Well, there was plenty of hay in the barns and one thing and another, and I got up with a couple of pals of mine on the top, a load of hay, but somebody else had seen us get up there. We were dug in nicely, and they started scrambling up, with the result that the whole lot collapsed. So then we had to find somewhere else. Eventually, we scattered around, some of them in a disused pigsty. It was happened to be clean, and they put plenty of straw or hay down there, and we had a comfortable night's rest. And the next morning, we still had tea and these biscuits again.
You must have been getting heartily sick of biscuits.
Oh, we lived on them for 6 weeks. One time, biscuits and bully. You see, we were at a disadvantage with the infantry in those days, because the infantry and the cavalry, they had their portable kitchens always following them. And that was a great big boiler, like you see the carry tar on them, you know, when they're tarring the roads. Open boiler on wheels, and a chimney going out of it, and a fire underneath. Well, next morning we set off and eventually got to Saint-Omer somewhere in the afternoon, where we had more tea and biscuits, and we sort of settled down there. The aircraft had already arrived, so we were, each flight took up his own position, its own position in relation to these aircraft. Well, at Saint-Omer we found our aircraft there, and we started unpacking our lorries. And amongst these lorries, we had a number of what they call RE hangars. These were like big canvas tents designed by the RE for the REs. And it didn't take us long to erect these, so we erected three or four of these for the aircraft to get them out of sight and under cover, and we settled down for the night. Well, two or three days after we'd been there and just got things organized, Lieutenant Moulin was his name. He went up on a reconnaissance flights.